Well, it's really an honor to be here. So thank you so much for having me, for showing up. I know we're all very busy. I speak to boards routinely, and what I often get from the boards of directors, not the compensation committees as much, but, you know, retirement plans, welfare benefit plans, it's all under control. Someone else is taking care of that. We don't really need to worry about ERISA, do we? And I think there are three precepts I'd like to make clear from the case study. Then I really do want to open this up to a dialogue and questions that or comments that this esteemed audience might have. But principle number one is that the board is a fiduciary to ERISA plans. And ERISA is something broadly defined as defined benefit, defined contribution, i.e. 401k. Welfare benefit, health insurance, and certain types of executive compensation that you might think of as SERPs, you can afford 409 cap A issues. So basically, they're a fiduciary, and not only is the board a fiduciary, the individual members of the boards are fiduciaries themselves. And fiduciary liability under ERISA is a personal liability. Now, you might think, well, this is a theoretical construct. And I would have agreed with you up till maybe 10 years ago, until the class action, the tort bar, started getting involved. And if you've been reading the Wall Street Journal, you'll be seeing the $300, $100 million, $60 million settlements that have been made against some of the biggest employers, publicly traded, but the private is coming up, in the country. Why did they settle? Because the class action bar is wise. You go after the company, you go after the board, and you go after people individually, which is exactly why Bechtel, one of the first to settle, settled. The second, the board doesn't like to be in the press. The individuals don't like it. Why would they? Nor do they want their houses on the line. The second issue with respect to ERISA liability is that there are numerous administration and investment elements that are of fiduciary nature that boards do not realize they are the de facto fiduciary with respect to. And they have all of the liability, but none of the real control. And that is a dangerous dichotomy that I see very often, even with the most sophisticated. And the third principle is that boards, and actually even just companies, when they're run, need to develop reasonable practices, protocols, and procedures for the delegation of responsibility for the maintenance and the management of their pension, welfare benefit, and executive compensation programs. Those are the three principles. Let me see how they play out. In our case, yes.
To the third point, at least the way this is worded here on the page, this doesn't ring true to my recollection. It says here, ERISA fiduciary liability, the responsible may undertake numerous strategies to mitigate fiduciary liability and delegate it to more appropriate risk center. My recollection is the ERISA fiduciary is able to delegate management of the fund, risk management of the fund, investments of the fund, but the ERISA does not allow them to delegate the responsibility. They ultimately are the accountable and responsible party.
The way ERISA works is, keep myself at this table. I'm Jewish. I talk with my hands. I can't help myself. So I will back away from the table. The way ERISA works is there are various gradations of being a fiduciary and various gradations of liability. The named fiduciary is what the employer is, and that is where all liability and responsibility ultimately resides. However, if one were to engage in appropriate substantive and procedural due diligence, so something akin to investment management, if you care, under ERISA Section 338, then all you got to do is hire a reasonable investment manager, like I'm pulling out a name, like BlackRock to manage your money, or GT Global, or someone to manage your money. And as long as you monitor that appropriately, your liability is not eliminated, you are right, but it is substantively and significantly mitigated. Concomitantly, with respect to administration of plans, again, the employer is going to be, in general, the named fiduciary. But if it engages in appropriate substantive and procedural diligence, then certain administrative functions, if anyone cares, 316 of ERISA, may appropriately be delegated to mitigate risk. I have found, however, that boards, and also just private companies, don't take advantage of risk mitigation, not elimination, and therefore all liability resides on the individuals as named fiduciaries, and that is problematic. Which leads me into the very case study that I think you're almost intuiting from your knowledge. And this case study is 21st Century Company. I'm trying to be creative here. Better than Company X, huh? It's a holding company for basically in the financial services IT industry. And it has a 401k plan that covers its 3,500 employees. It has just acquired a parent-subsidiary relationship, which you guys would know from the Internal Revenue Code means that a controlling interest of at least 80% or more. For techies out there, it's Internal Revenue Code Section 1563. So you have a parent-subsidiary relationship of three new companies it just acquired. One has, I know you know I'm going with this, one has a profit-sharing plan, one has a 401k plan, one has a defined benefit plan. There's another company that was just acquired. This company's in the print business, somehow related to, in a conglomerate sense, to financial services and IT. However, here there's not a controlling interest. There's a 50% interest. This company has an ESOP and certain union members that are under a CBA, collective bargaining agreement, with the United Steelworkers. Now, this company, you know, just hired the best lawyer in the world, whose name happens to be Marsha. So, just randomly. So, Marsha L. Eagle is the new general counsel of 21st Century. And she has stellar, excellent credentials and wonderful experience coming from other companies that have been at the forefront of ERISA employee benefits and executive compensation. And when she was interviewing for the job at 21st Century, one of the members of the board took her aside and basically said, hey, listen, we've been a little lackadaisical with respect to our defined contribution, defined benefit in ESOP world. We kind of just find benefits as a necessary evil to keep employees. And maybe, you know, if you're going to be the new general counsel, maybe you might want to look into this. So Marsha, with the blessings of the CEO, decided to dive into what she was able to find, what they had for documentation.
Time out. We're going to let Rick Williams sit.
What they had for documentation and everything else. She immersed herself, as only Marsha L. Eagle could do, in what, very subtle, I know, in what they had. And what she found with respect to the vendor contracts and the plan documentation and the administrative service agreements didn't surprise her, kind of dismayed her a little bit. And she found out that the plan documents name the board, the employer, as the named fiduciary. She found out that there was a passive trustee for most of the tax-qualified plans that limited its liability to just taking direction and nothing more, and charged a somewhat hefty fee for that. She found out there was no investment committee, no plan administration committee, no ERISA committee to holistically deal with benefits. She found out that various and sundry executives, through historical purposes, some from HR, some from finance, some the CEO himself, dealt with various aspects of the pension and benefits arrangements. She found out that the welfare benefits, life, health, AD&D, STD, LTD, BTA, all of the alphabet soup of welfare benefits, which is scattered about in little insurance contracts, and no one was watching privacy and security. She found out there were various and sundry executive compensation agreements, some severance agreements, some employment contracts, some SERPs, some top hat agreements for various executives that no one had organized or even knew about in any organized, holistic, unified fashion. Moreover, she found out that all of the responsibility for this, because nothing was delegated officially to any committee, resided in the board. So they had all the liability and responsibility and no effective control. She also found out that the RIA, do you guys know what that is? The Registered Investment Advisor for the majority of the tax-qualified plans was Long-Term Returns, Inc., which charged 150 basis points to wrap and do it all, education, advice, and everything. And it was affiliated with a money manager that had proprietary product that sold, that had 12B1 fees. You know what those are? Those are the, that had 12B1 fees and revenue sharing. She also found out that in the preceding 5 years, 401k contributions, that's the elective deferrals that are made, weren't always made very timely. And that there was, that the plan documents, no one could even find them. They were scattered about and not organized. So Marcia thinks there could be some true exposure for the board on a variety of issues. And she's wondering what to recommend to the board, how to present that to them. And this is a case study that I ask you to help Marcia L. Eagle with right now. And I'd love to hear what you have to say.
First of all, I'm not surprised. What you described for a holding company that was agglomerating companies by acquisition from different industries, that's really easy for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And having, as a CEO, made decisions on 401k plans, I'm amazed at the number of selections that you can have from like a Fidelity, for example, of the different investment vehicles. That
no selection. That green
boards.
Line is going to lead you right to the Freedom Funds. There's no selection. I'm joking.
And so, yeah, what you've described is no big surprise, and it shouldn't have been a surprise to Marcia when she came in.
Well, but Marcia L. Eagle is now thinking, wow, I'm the new kid on the block. How do I advise and what do I tell my board to do and not get fired? Yes.
Well, I have to comment that CFOs, this company, should be fired. Because normally benefit plans and related HR issues come up through the CFO, but in most big companies that I know of, mm-hmm. the CFO has one of his responsibilities is managing mm-hmm. the benefit plans,
mm-hmm.
which he can either delegate out, ship out like these guys did,
mm-hmm.
probably for less money than this guy did.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, the fact that there was no one, there's no plan documents, no coordination, that's the CFO's job.
And CEO.
Yes,
and
but
the
mostly
and
the CEO will often delegate it to the CFO.
And where was the board and their oversight in asking?
Well, they were, or the board's finance committee. The audit committee would have an issue with this too, because that's really where it's going to come up to the board.
There are a lot of people at fault here, I think.
So would it be in your area and in the companies you've been in?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it yes, except that legal would be involved, the CEO would be involved, and we're lacking information. For all we know, the CFO could have raised it many times and been shot down. We have no information. That's why I'm jumping in the way I jumped in. So to me, this is a breakdown of governance, is essentially what this
is. It's also
is.
Lack of start due diligence
at the board,
in the acquisitions.
Start at the board and just go down. And who's, I mean, you've got a lot of people at fault. And the only question is, who's really at fault? Well, you don't have enough information to know. Who tried to do what?
Well, who's at fault and what you're going to do about it, board?
Well,
Marsha L. Eagle says, Marsha, the wonderful lawyer, Marsha L. Eagle, this fantastically good lawyer, Marsha L. Eagle, and very humble lawyer, I hear Marsha L. Eagle is as well, basically has decided that she's not going to cast aspersions. It doesn't matter whose fault it is. It's a conglomerate.
Let's fix the problem.
Let's fix the problem. Like so it. How is Marsha L. Eagle going to tell them? Oh, I don't have a... It doesn't matter. So I was going to write, but it doesn't... So how is Marsha L. Eagle going to fix this? The first thing Marsha is going to tell the... was it right there and I missed it? And Marsha's kind of blind. The first thing that Marsha is going to tell the board is that the best thing to do is to create, and she could come up with a sexier name, I'm sure, if she had time to come up with it, which she didn't, but create an ERISA charter. Figure out who is responsible for what. Human resources is usually very much involved on the welfare benefit side with health insurance. And mind you, the Affordable Care Act, ACA, which kind of step back a second, ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, and then I promise I'll get back to the ERISA Charter. The Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974 basically deals in three distinct areas, all of which are at the forefront of legislative, judicial, and regulatory change. And this is front page newspaper almost every day. This and domestic security are the domestic underpinning initiatives of what's going on in our country, actually, in Western civilization. So what are the three areas of ERISA that are so important? The first is pension benefits. This is what Marsha L. Eagle is focusing on, but that's only a third of it. And by pension benefit, I mean defined benefit, private and public. So the governmental underfunding and stuff like that, that's all related. So public and private defined benefit, defined contribution, which you guys will know as 401k, then the tax-exempt sector, 403b, 457b, et cetera. That's all pension benefit. Then there's welfare benefit. That's all the fringes. That's the health, the life, the benefits that make up the employment package. So the Affordable Care Act, people call ACA, well, guess what? It's ERISA. It comes under my statute. So I've got an entire department now that's focused exclusively on the ACA because it's extremely important that HR or finance or both get on top of this because the sanctions on ACA, even if you think everyone's covered, even if you think you have minimally appropriate benefits, it could be very, very costly. Mistakes here matter a lot. Then the third area that is ERISA is executive compensation. So executive, that's stuff like it can be stock options, qualified and non-qualified, ISO and non-ISO. It can be phantom arrangements, in other words, shadow stock arrangements. It can be just SERP, supplemental executive retirement plans, deferred compensation. So if you have an employment contract which provides for the deferral of receipt of income, guess what? That's deferred compensation. And that game changed significantly through a certain Internal Revenue Code section, 409 Cap A, which really changes many things, but not least of which, the amount of time things can be deferred and how distribution must occur. If your plans haven't been reviewed for 409 Cap A, there is liability here. So therefore, that was all as background to get us back to the ERISA Charter. Given that Marsha L. Eagle knows all this, the ERISA Charter is going to divide up what the company has and who's going to be responsible. So who's going to be responsible for pension benefits, administration, and investment? Two very distinct things. Who's going to administer the quadros, qualified domestic relations or divorces, for example, or getting the elective deferrals into the trustee or the custodian timely? And who's going to be responsible for hiring Leg Mason or whomever, or to do an RFP for Fidelity? And to make sure the record keeping is appropriate. So basically, who does the qualified plan work? And then who does the admin? And then who does the investments? Now this has no...
There's another one right there.
Who does admin and who does investments? A qualified. For welfare benefit, when was the last time there was an RFP done for the health, the life? Has there ever been an audit to make sure that you don't have dependents that are 50 years old still on this plan, or five wives still on this plan? If it's self-insured, are you complying with HIPAA? Do you guys know what HIPAA is? It's Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Well, guess what? The sanctions for violation of that, even inadvertent, even if you're hacked, are huge. What are you doing? Do you have HIPAA protocols, procedures? Do you have HIPAA training? Are you making sure that only people who have a need to know what's called protected health information, PHI, and there's also just protected personal information, PPI, that only those people have it, and how are you documenting that? Because an audit is all documentation. So who has welfare benefit responsibilities under this ERISA charter? Marsha L. Eagle wants to know. For executive compensation, oh, these are the executives. They've got to be treated differently, which, by the way, isn't true. If you tell the truth to power, it's cool. They respect it. They really do. For the executives, what do you even have for executive compensation? Is it unified? Is it reasonable? Is it rational? Does anyone even know? Or do they wait until the guy hits 65 and he pulls out a contract from 1975? It's a shock because it's unfunded. If you're going to fund it, how are you going to fund it? Are you going to fund it with a rabbi trust? Do you guys, no offense to rabbis at all, a rabbi trust is merely a grantor trust under Internal Revenue Code Section 1041 that basically is a funding vehicle that is not that is subject to claims of general creditors on bankruptcy or insolvency, which is usually a theoretical issue, but it stops constructive receipt, so stops the immediate taxation of income in the taxable world, which is not true in the tax-exempt world. So all of you on tax-exempt boards, if there's vesting in a deferred comp plan, there's taxation. You need to be aware of that. Who's responsible for the rabbi trust if there's going to be funding? Is there funding with split dollar? Is a split dollar in the red or in the black? If it's in the red, as it probably is, who's going to make the executive whole? Has anyone looked at this from a funding perspective? Has anyone looked at it from a coherence perspective? So this is what Marsha L. Eagle will say has to be created for an ERISA charter. You put it in writing. Then when you put it in writing, you break down what you have and what you don't have. And in the pension world, you look at, hey, listen, what's headline news? What is really pissing off the government now and the tort bar? And you will find there are three things. The first thing is fees and reasonableness of, let me back up. There's a real concern. There's a real concern that Americans are going to outlive their retirement savings. So I'm moving away, just so we're clear, I am now moving away from this, not to understate it, because this, especially with the ACA, is very important. You need ERISA counsel. I am now moving into this realm of our ERISA committee. Okay? There's a real issue. And it's on every talk show. In fact, President Obama mentions it often, which I find amazing. He's such a wonk on ERISA. It's so annoying. You don't want the president to focus on your area of law, trust me. In every single State of the Union, he won't use the word ERISA, but it will be 5% or 10% of his presentation. And you just die. You're like, no, not another change. So in any event, what the middle class task force is really concerned with is the threat to the social contract that is likely going to occur in about 10 years. The middle class task force is probably one of the most powerful task forces based right at the White House, chaired by Vice President Biden, who people make fun of, but that's actually very unfair. He's a very bright man. From I don't know him personally, but from people I know who do know him, he's apparently amazingly sharp. And it's also on the middle class task force is the head of Treasury, head of IRS, two different agencies that people aren't aware of, DOL, head of the Fed. Very, very important, prominent task force. That's also very quiet. And their main goal is to help the middle class because there's a deep concern that with the pressure Medicare and Social Security are under, and the fact that people aren't saving enough, that we're going to have a crisis of the upper middle class and lower wealthy, and maybe even middle class, who can't afford to sustain their standard of living within a decade. And that can be 2 seconds. And that can be extremely problematic and rip at the social fabric. So the Middle Class Task Force has, for the past 7 years, really gone after ERISA with respect to things like transparency of fees, reporting, disclosure. And that was done to really decrease the margins of people like Fidelity. The owners of the Lynches are one of they're a little less rich right now. You know what I mean? Ned Johnson and Abby are a little less rich because there's been margin compression significantly in the record keeper arena, and it's going to happen in the money manager arena as well. It's coming, without doubt, because what the government is trying to do is that if you decrease margins of the intermediaries or even the manufacturers of product. That means the effective rate of return of participants, beneficiaries, alternate payees under plans increases. And that they think that that will be helpful. So one of the main issues the government is focusing on and focusing on substantively of the three is fees and conflicts of interest, all of which we have up the wazoo with, what did I call it, with Long-Term Returns, Inc. The second thing the government is really very concerned with is if an employer takes employees' money to purchase things like health insurance, no one pays 100% anymore, and a 401k contributions, a 403b, a 457b, at least, not F, contributions, then that money has to go as soon as reasonably practicable into trust or into custody outside of the corporation. So if 21st Century Co. has been holding on to this money for 3 months for the float, or through incompetence, or because they couldn't get ADP to talk to Fidelity or Principal or Vanguard correctly, there is some significant exposure here. And the third thing that annoys the government very, very much is, you know, a pension document, a welfare benefit document. These are legal contracts. They're sophisticated and they're important contracts. They're not merely fill-in-the-blank things that some HR director or even sub-director has in some folder that no one can find. Where are your plan documents? Where are your protocols? Where is your investment policy statement? Where are the operational documents that talk about the contractual relationship you, the employer, i.e. the board, have with your employees, and in certain circumstances, leased employees, shared employees, and independent contractors?
I'm going to resign from the board.
But Marsha L. Eagle says, we can work through this. And the board says,
how much?
This is how much.
I want the CFO, I want the pilot.
Okay, can I? So, Charlie, I'm not sure that's the right response.
No.
Because a CFO has this whole breadth of responsibility. And he may be a wizard at M&A, he may be a wizard at operational control, and short-suited in this area. And you don't necessarily groom him. What you may do is prop him up with someone else.
Well, no.
We don't
should,
even know if it's his job.
Have...
Wait a second, Jeremy. We don't even know if it's his job in this company. We have no information as to who it was, and you keep coming out and saying, let's hang somebody.
But the CFO is responsible for the due diligence on the acquisitions. One of the things you look at closely in these acquisitions is the benefit plans, both retirement and other. All right? He should know that information, have it documented as part of his due diligence responsibilities in the acquisition. That's his job.
You could equally well say fire the general counsel.
I mean, it's the fact that there's not
the
he may need the benefits and an HR personnel.
What compensation committee of a board doesn't know what the compensation obligations are?
That's what the compensation committee is for.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that. In the whole scheme of things, you know, the CFO has a lot of responsibility, and there are many players who have their finger in this pie, including HR, as Jill said.
Well, I'll come to Charlie's house because at the top, at the top of page three, item number three, the very first paragraph, that's all the grounds you need to support Charlie's contention that this CFO is totally asleep at the switch, could have hired a high school intern one summer to grapple with this stuff. But, you know, there it is, festering. And these kinds of duplicate costs, unnecessary costs,
you got a multi-divisional company. You're going to have at the head an HR person who's responsible for the benefit plans and, to some extent, the compensation plans. Whether that person reports to the CFO or reports directly to the CEO, that's or a VP of administration, one of those three. But in either event, the CFO is generally the guy who's doing the legwork on due diligence and the acquisitions. And these all came together as a group of acquisitions.
Let us just say that not everybody in the room agrees with you, and could we focus on how we fix the problem?
Great idea.
Okay.
The biggest liability here, however, is the union plan that we haven't even discussed.
Right.
Because there's 50% ownership here of the print co. Does anyone know how underfunded? Ha! I tricked you all. Yes.
Is it a multi-employer union plan where there are multiple companies as part of the defined benefits, and therefore the liability can be excessive because some of the companies in a multi-employer union plan can even go bankrupt, and the liability rests with the remaining party. And if you acquire a company, you're inheriting that underfunded liability.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Assuming this was a stock acquisition, if it was an asset acquisition, it's a little different, but
right.
Assuming, arguendo, this was a stock acquisition, which is, by the way, when you guys acquire things, get your ERISA lawyer involved immediately. These are things
again,
that are...
There's a rep in every M&A agreement the plans meet ERISA requirements. Doing your due diligence means you talk to somebody who's behind that rep.
You know what I say about reps and warranties? It's better to know than to have a good rep and warranty, because oftentimes there's a materiality clause. If something isn't worth more than $50 million, then they go through materiality and then say, well, we sort of disclosed it, but you didn't understand it. I agree. I review reps and warranties as part of my job for law firms that don't have decent ERISA, or even those that do have decent but not decent enough ERISA counsel. So I understand, but it's good to have that, and it's good to have good and protective language. But the way ERISA has grown, people don't even think of HIPAA and COBRA as ERISA liabilities. But you don't have a COBRA form out in time. And someone has, and this actually happened to one of my clients, someone has a car accident. And then you're like, holy shoot, we have to send out a COBRA form because that person was laid off 30 days ago or 45 days ago and it's outside the COBRA period. Guess who's self-insuring that poor quadriplegic? The board. So where is your liability here? Your liability is twofold. Board members that you didn't even think of. I'll get to the multi-employer liability in a second because I wanted to find that a little bit more in depth than what you did. But also, there's no fiduciary liability insurance. You think E&O really covers this? No. Check out your E&O policies. E&O carves out ERISA for the most part. So does D&O. Look at the policy. See if you need fiduciary liability policies or see if you can get a rider. On your, probably not on your, you probably can't get it on E&O, but see if you can get a rider on your D&O for ERISA. And make sure ERISA, when they define it, it isn't just qualified. Because the real problem is going to be with HIPAA and COBRA, I might add. And messing up 409 CAFE on the executives for executive deferred comp. So make sure ERISA is defined broadly, and not just for federal laws, but ERISA doesn't preempt all state laws. So make sure it's ERISA, employee benefits, executive compensation laws federally and at the state level. You will thank me one day for that. Trust me, many have over the 30 years I've been practicing law. So your first liability, board members, is your insurance. Do you know how you're insured? Do you? Your second liability is, does this have insurance, your qualified plan? Qualified plans need bonds. They need surety bonds. More than half don't have them. What if there's something wrong that happens with the ERISA plan and there's no bonding or there's inadequate bonding? You guys are liable. So, board members, are you insured? Do you know what's in your wallet? Sorry, credit card advertisers. It was a bad joke. Good laugh. I'm trying here. The other liability is that can literally swallow up companies, and I've seen it happen, is multi-employer. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit. And then I'd like to talk about defined benefit more in general. Is everyone here clear on the concept as to what is a defined benefit plan and what is a defined contribution plan?
Yep.
Okay, great. You wouldn't believe how often people are like, no. I'm like, really? Do you live in this country? All right. So with I feel sorry if that one person's like, no, but I'm not going to say anything now. There are two ways that groups of unrelated and unaffiliated employers can get together. Way number one, which is going to become very popular because the Obama administration is pushing it big time, is something called the Multiple Employer Plan, a MEP. This is when unrelated employers get together and they try to pool their resources for administration, investment, etc. There are state initiatives to create state-based MEPs, I might add. Connecticut's well down the way, California's well on that way, and so is Massachusetts, I might add. The second way, those can be defined benefit or defined contribution in nature. You should really know about this. It's going to affect the world in a very substantive way within the next few years. The second way that unrelated, unaffiliated employers get together is through something called a multiple employer plan, a multi-employer plan. A multi-employer plan is a plan that's usually under a collective bargaining arrangement, a CBA, and it's usually run by a board. Three people will represent management. Three people usually represent employers or the labor union. And there are three principal kinds of multiple employer plan, two of which often have unfunded or underfunded liability. There's defined benefit plans, which pay, as you know, a benefit for life, usually with very significant COLA, cost of living adjustment. There's something called a VEBA, a Voluntary Employees Beneficiary Association, which is a tax-exempt trust under Internal Revenue Code Section 501(c)(9). And it funds the welfare benefits, usually the very rich welfare benefits, health insurance, life insurance, etc., apprenticeship training for the unions. And then the third is defined contribution. It's very hard to be underfunded in a defined contribution unless there are two types of defined contribution that can be underfunded. And be careful, because some unions have them. So when you're reading your reps and warranties, you need to be aware of this. The two types of defined contribution, multi-employer plans that can be underfunded, and people miss this all the time, are target benefit plans and money purchase pension plans. So what you need to know is that when an entity engages, becomes a participating employer, and a multi-plan, then the liability for any and all underfunding is joint and several and is not pro rata necessarily. It's a very complex calculation, which, by the way, I might add the unions always get wrong. So if you have an unfunded multi-employer plan and someone's assessing withdrawal liability, bring them to us. Because we can always shave off some money, at least. We can't shave it to zero, but we can always help with just knowing basic math, which is pathetic.
Well, I think this board has agreed we're not going to fire the CFO. What are we going to do?
You're going to figure out how much your underfunded liability is.
Well, you started out by talking about setting up a charter, and then you have a few things on your third page here that talk about engaging an investment advisor, procuring ERISA fiduciary insurance. What else would we do you recommend? You're recommending to us, the board.
I recommend, this is what I recommend, and this is what my firm does a lot of. I'll get into those details, but I don't want to like use the terminology. The word is a gap analysis. I think that if someone hasn't looked at ERISA plans from a, I'm not talking from a labor perspective. People confuse labor and employment law with ERISA. They're two very distinct things. So I'm not talking about HR knowing what the Family and Medical Leave Act is, or they don't discriminate against people based on race, religion, all that stuff. I'm not talking about that. If someone has it holistically from an HR or CFO or CEO perspective, looked at the benefit plans, then what I think you, the board, should do is two things. You should engage competent counsel to engage in a gap analysis, to figure out what you have and then what you need to be minimally compliant with the law, and then what you should do in order to have best practices. So I think that I think you should engage Marsha Eagle to engage maybe another Marsha to do a gap analysis to figure out where you are, what's needed, and where you should go. What will Marsha L. Eagle likely come back with at a minimum? At a minimum, Marsha's going to come back with, listen, let's do an RFP for our record keeper, see if we can bring down the administration costs. Let's do an RFP to get an, you know, right now we might, we, you know, let's make sure that we have an RIA and figure out what benchmark data should be with respect to what we should be paying for assets for a plan, for an amalgam of plans of the control group of our size. Maybe we should also hire a wonderful ERISA law firm to figure out if the benefits are rational, because they look like they've kind of grown up, like mushroomed up over time. But maybe we should have some type of fairness between and amongst the different control group members. We don't want one plan being extremely wealthy, like the defined benefit plan, and then another subsidiary having just a 401k plan. By the way, that might not even be legal, because when you're in a controlled group, benefits can be disparate amongst the controlled group members, but they can't be too disparate. If they're too disparate, you disqualify the plans. And plan disqualification, it's not something you want to enter into, because even though the IRS doesn't disqualify plans, I assure you negotiating for reasonable sanctions is difficult, having done it many times myself on just this issue in conglomerates. Marsha will also likely say that it's a good idea to RFP the administration. Let's get a professional third-party administrator. Maybe we bundle it with the record keeper. But we should see what they do, and we should do on-site visits. And we need to make sure that they can play well in the sandbox with ERISA counsel and with our payroll provider. Because oftentimes, even the vendors like to have their own little fiefdoms. I think that Marsha Eagle will also say, wait a second, what welfare benefits do we have? We have now 9 different subsidiaries. We have 20 different brokers. What are we doing? What do we have? Can we get economies of scale by consolidation? And should we fund this with a VEBA, a tax-exempt trust that could help us and help our bottom line and really help in the financial statements? Or are we large enough that we should consider self-insuring? Why are we making Aetna richer? And if we self-insure, what kind of stop loss do we need, individual and aggregate? And if we buy stop loss, how do we know we're buying it from someone good? I mean, yeah.
So to Warren's question, what we should be, you know, one of the issues for the board, one of them is how to manage this.
Right.
And are we going to give the authority to the CFO? Are we going to give it to the general counsel? Are we going to create a committee that includes the CFO, the general counsel, and the VP HR?
I think what you would do is you would have, and this is why I actually initially came to Larry, because I really wanted to get on a board and be a member of a compensation committee, because I've given advice to so many of them. I'm thinking, God, I should be on that. This is, but you know, I really don't care at this point. I think that the authority should be with a compensation committee or even a subcommittee of the compensation committee. And then these people should figure out their team. that they're going to work with and delegate. Now, it can be outside counsel or consultant or what have you, but there's got to be a point person who's working day-to-day inside the company and outside the company to figure all this out, then report back to the subcommittee, which reports back to that committee, which reports back to the board. I really think one of the beauties of ERISA, which is kind of funny to say, is the fact that it's very much a procedural statute. And if you implement reasonable protocols and procedures, then that's like more than half the battle. So the issue is, how do you start that? And I just think it's in that direction. And that's just, it's not just common sense. It's just that's what practice bears out as working.
Go ahead.
To get back to something you spoke about earlier, I was just curious, what entity is responsible for enforcing reasonableness of fees, and how do those issues get on their radar screen?
Right now, who's enforcing reasonableness of fees? Of the tort bar, the class action lawsuit bar. They very, very much are. And now the Department of Labor is getting very involved. When you file a Form 5500 for your welfare benefits, there's something called a Schedule A that lists compensation to the brokers. When you file it for a pension benefit plan, there's something called a Schedule C that lists the compensation. And now the DOL is looking at this, and I'm seeing audits on fees that seem outside the norm. Moreover, there's a cottage industry that's developing of benchmarking called Brightscope, and Morningstar does this, and I think Financial Engines is also starting to benchmark. So there are certain companies that are starting to benchmark reasonableness of fees in light of services. And that's how it's coming to people's radar. It's a very, very hot topic.
Yes. Go ahead, Rick.
I'm going to switch roles here for a second as to whose question this is. If I were going on this board, so I'm a new board person, and somehow or another, you know, either because Marcia came on and made the presentation, or somehow I discovered all of this, it seems to me there's sort of two different issues. One is, you're saying the board members individually have a lot of liability here.
Right? If there's been no delegation,
right.
Yes.
So the first question would be, okay, assuming the board members go along with this, there's some long-term way process for straightening all this out. There also should be a question about, well, what do we do in the interim to minimize our own personal liability? And so how do we demonstrate that we're acting in good faith, in a prudent manner, protecting the interests of the current and former employees, but also recognize that it may take time to sort all this out? I mean, what would you say we should be doing to address those two different issues?
Sure. And I have two answers. The first is, it's really important if you do have something like this or akin to this, that you run things through your lawyer. And I mean that for attorney-client privilege. Attorney-client privilege is actually even stronger than, you know, parishioner-priest privilege. You know, it's really strong. It's very hard to break attorney-client privilege. And
almost
that,
as strong as HIPAA.
Sorry?
Almost as strong as HIPAA.
Almost as strong as HIPAA. So it really is something that you're going to want to utilize in a prophylactic sort of way. And the... oh, come on. The second... I meant that normally. The second thing you're going to want to do is you're going to want to have that gap analysis. And any good gap analysis is going to say, these are the low-hanging fruit issues, that this is bad. These are the things you have to deal with now. These are red light things. And there are never more than two or three of them. This one is probably the 12b-1 fees and the proprietary funds on the 401k platform. And at least getting your arms around how large is the multi-employer withdrawal liability issue. So, I mean, there are usually going to be red lights. Oh, and if you don't have fiduciary liability insurance, those are your three red lights. Fix them immediately. And then you can go on to other issues in the gap analysis. But any good analysis is going to say, oh, God, this has got to be fixed within 2 weeks, this within four, this within six, you know, then this stuff within 6 to 10 months or what have you.
We are approaching the soft stop. The soft
oh, my
stop
goodness.
There. So the question is,
you're having too much fun.
But the way we do it is, if you'd like to continue the conversation, fine. If you'd like to get up and leave, fine. The time is allotted for this has happened. I would just like to say, at this point, of course, thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.
It was a tour de force. And I'm awfully glad you answered Rick's question. I'm just a new member on the board. What has to happen that covers me while we're fixing this?
That's right.
And I think that was a great question and was a great answer.
Thank you.
So thank you all very much.
Marcia, you mentioned HIPAA about 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
And normally, in my world, I think of HIPAA around hospitals, around healthcare providers, information providers. I don't think of it so much as employers. So enlighten us on what the HIPAA risks are and how they aggregate at the board level.
When you go to a hospital and you sign in, there's always a piece of paper that says a Health Insurance Portability and Protection Act of 1996. You don't even read it. You sign it, right? And I got to tell you, I made a very good friend because she's an optometrist. And back in 1998, I went to get my eyes checked or something. I saw her HIPAA form. And I don't know what lawyer created it, but I was like, I was aghast. I couldn't even read this thing. I was correcting it for her. You know, I'm like, no, this is what you have to have in there. So I think I couldn't. I couldn't stop myself. And I'm telling you, all the HIPAA forms you guys sign now, my work product, because my typos are still in there. So you're welcome. People cut and paste it in news from all over the country. But in any event, you can't make this stuff up. But HIPAA deals with health insurance, and the employer provides health insurance. And as such, it's going to get information that is, it's called protected health information. And it's personally identifiable with respect to their person, his social security number, type of diseases, type of risk mitigation, you will claim.
I would disagree with that only because if you self-insure, you hire a TPA to do it. They've got the HIPAA responsibilities. If you're buying insurance from an Aetna or somebody like that, you are not getting that information. You're
see
not
that, that
to get
that's
that
what
information.
That's what you would think. So let me finish my thought, and then I promise you I will deal with that because I hear it all the time. Give me a second. So anything with respect to health insurance, this personally identifiable information, is in fact protected, and the law is very strict as to who can see this, how they can access it, how it has to be protected, that there has to be training at the HR level, the CFO level. Now, if you have a self-insured plan, you may well have a TPA that administers the plan, but at the end of the day, the premium claims, the amount of benefits, if there's a preemie baby, all this stuff will flow,
right,
usually through HR.
Insurance rates, that's right. The amount of money you're spending at the TPA, that's correct.
But the way it will flow through with the self-insured arrangement is that people in HR will know, and they will approve or not approve. There'll be a claims adjudication process.
Right.
And this is... I know I'm right. I do this for a living. So.
The reason I know this is I funded and started a TPA with a friend of mine.
Oh, which one?
So, and I was aware that the employers, you know, what affected the amount of money that was spent at the TPA, mm-hmm. if you have a cancer patient, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that just sent your reimbursement rates way up. If mm-hmm. you have a preemie. Mm-hmm. It sent your reimbursement rates way up. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, the employer does know the outliers.
Yeah, absolutely. And even more so when it has an aging workforce, when it tries to engage in wellness and something proactive.
Exactly.
You also get, and you will find that in the insured area as well, maybe not as much because you'll be giving it to Blue Cross or HMO Blue or whatever, but still there you'll see claims information. You will see, if you have a 125 plan, do you guys know what a 125 plan is? It's a plan for those who use pre-tax money to buy insurance. You get information back from that. If you have an FSA, a flexible spending account, guess what? What do people use their FSAs for? To buy medicine. This is all PHI, and it all flows through HR. And that stuff has to be regulated and watched, and you have to have HIPAA processes in place. And the Department of Health and Human Services is now aware that large companies, public and private, don't realize that HIPAA impacts them. They think if it's a hospital or a doctor or my anesthesiologist
test. No, but to the extent they know about the health of their employees, they are responsible for protecting that information.
Yes, that's and they right. don't. And that's, or they don't do it in a way that's HIPAA compliant. Right.
Okay, Mike's going off.
slander and libel.
Yeah.
And the deep pocket here is Fox.
So
they
have
a duty. They have a duty. No, that's not right. And
we still have a duty. Twice it was on Fox.
Oh, poor guy.
Oh, no, it just destroyed him.
You know, things like that.